Beckett looked out to an open door of the warehouse, a wide space filled with Huddersfield staffers peering in at them. "They're hoping for a glimpse of the woman," Wycombe Finch said, seeing the direction of Beckett's gaze. "Shiles has posted guards to keep them out."
"Yeah."
Beckett started to move toward the door, but was stopped by the director's hand on his arm.
"Bill, go very gently with Stoner. He is a dangerous man."
"I will."
Beckett nodded toward the staffers at the door.
"We'll have to let them see her sometime soon. A schedule of viewing or something.
Shiles has it in hand.
Better have the viewers search to make sure no one brings a hammer to crack the viewing port.
You don't really think," he sniffed. "This is England. We've put out the word that all non-essential personnel must stay away. At any rate, there'll be nothing to see except a big wooden room and a small metal cylinder."
"What phone can I use for Stoner?" Beckett asked.
"The ad building security office just across the way is probably the closest. First on your right after you go through the entrance."
Beckett strode toward the doorway, where he was delayed by the press of people demanding, "Do they really have a woman over there?"
"And her husband and her daughter," Beckett said. "You'll have to stay away from them for now, though."
"My God, man," someone said. "Don't you know how long it's been since we've seen a woman?"
"There's no way you can see her just yet," Beckett said, pulling away. He strode quickly across the grounds, leaving the crowd at the doorway, but not before he heard someone say, "Bloody Yanks!" His way was lighted by the constant pathway illumination that made the Huddersfield establishment look like a busy factory complex at night. A great many people were up and around, he noted, more of the curious coming to peer into the warehouse. The security office also was brilliantly illuminated. A guard sat behind the single small desk in the room, his attention on TV monitors overhead. At Beckett's request, he pushed a telephone across the desk but kept his gaze on the monitors. The operator put Stoner on the line immediately.
"Where did they have to go to get you?" Stoner demanded. "Land's End?"
Stoner on the telephone was no more pleasant than Stoner in person, Beckett thought.
"I was in the warehouse where we've lodged the container with that Irish couple."
"Is it true she had a baby on the crossing?"
"Yes, a daughter. Premature. It's going to be touch and go."
"Two guinea pigs for your serum, though."
"Truer than you think. They may have been contaminated."
"Well, I imagine we'll scare up quite a few women when we announce your serum."
"You announce nothing until we've tested it."
"Of course, old man, of course."
Stoner sounded almost pleasant.
"You're pretty confident of the thing, aren't you?"
"We have our fingers crossed. Those last bits from the Irish really put us over the top. Quintuplicate series in the Messenger code, by God!
They must have gotten that directly from O'Neill. The Irish could never have come up with it on their own."
"It's true they have O'Neill himself?"
"Doubt it not, old fellow. Bloody fecal matter hitting the bloody fan, too. Our informants say they're on the edge of civil war. One lot's holed up in their research facility, hoping that'll keep them safe from direct attack. Another lot got most of the northeast coast and quite a few places inland. Typical Irish dust-up."
Beckett looked at the back of the security guard's neck, wondering at Stoner's manner. The man sounded almost chatty, even friendly.
"Where do they have O'Neill?" Beckett asked.
"At that research facility, we're told." "Say, Bill, I'd like you to put me thoroughly in the picture, if you will. I've a meeting coming up with the Prime Minister and the King. Bit of technical jargon, that sort of thing."
Stoner actually chuckled.
"Everyone's quite excited. What is it you're doing, actually?"
Beckett nodded to himself. The picture had become exceedingly clear. Dangerous man indeed. He wanted something to impress the brass. "Our approach is to give a disease to the disease," Beckett said. "You know that the 20 possible amino acids are sequenced by the genetic code. The plague interferes with that sequencing. It inserts a new message to control the biochemical activity in the cells.
The coding of the cells by which they perform their special functions is addressed by the plague. Specific messages to specific types of cells. Are you getting all this?
Recording it, old chap. It'll be typed off for me. Do continue, if you please.
Use the spiral staircase analogy, Beckett said. It's a genetic disease attacking the DNA helix at critical places in the staircase.
Quite.
Stoner managed to sound elated, but dry. When the new message is injected into a transmitting cell, instead of a quadratic form, it's carried in a series of fives.
That thing they passed along from O'Neill.
Quite. Beckett took delight in imitating Stoner, but apparently the man did not notice. We knew O'Neill must have used a virus as his messenger into the bacterial host, he said. And there was that tantalizing clue of the similarity to granulocytic leukemia.
And what does that mean, old chap, if they should ask?
It indicates a disruption of the normal genetic coding. The structure of the DNA was certainly changed.
Quite.
And why doesn't it attack men? There's no biochemical niche where the plague pathogen can lock itself in and do its dirty work. It's broken down by the bodily mechanism that regulates the rate of cellular growth. Beckett smiled to himself, realizing he had just passed along all of the essential information that would alert a knowledgeable person to the other things they would be able to do. No more mitotic disease. An end to cancer. They would be able to control the energy-building activities of related RNA. And much more.
That's splendid, Stoner said. You did a lot of work on the old computer, didn't you?
Oh, yes, Beckett thought. Have to bring in the great new tool of science. He said, we had two things going for us there. A superb new search program developed by a young American, plus the image enhancement techniques that NASA produced to improve pictures sent back from space. We were able to see things within the genetic structure never before seen.
O'Neill must have seen them, Stoner said.
Quite, Beckett said.
That search program, that was the thing your man Ruckerman brought over?
Yes.
I've had him brought down here, you know. King requested it. Quite a lot of chin-chin to go through about the new world setup.
Beckett crossed his fingers.
I imagine so. Ruckerman, representing your president, the king there, the prime minister, very high level.
And you think you're right in the middle of it, Beckett thought.
Oh, by the by, Stoner said, you may be interested to know that Changsha is making a guarded announcement about a cure.
The Chinese?
They're giving no details, but the signal is clear enough, old chap. They use the word cure.
Stoner cleared his throat.
The Japanese and the Soviets are still silent about their progress, but Jaipur is saying now that it will be accepting bids within a month for a chemical treatment of the plague that has produced remarkable results.
Their words.
That is interesting, especially about the Chinese. Pass it along to Y, will you, old chap?
Of course. Give Ruckerman my regards.
Certainly. We're getting along famously, you know. But I must say he'll never be able to say quite as well as you do.
The connection was broken with a definite click. Before Beckett could hang up, Shiles came on the line.
Wait there, will you, Bill? I'll be right over.
Beckett put the phone back in its cradle. Shiles had been listening. What did that mean? Probably nothing much. Everyone took it for granted that all conversations were monitored. But Shiles himself on this one. A white-smocked figure thrust open the security office door, then ignored Beckett and addressed the guard monitoring the TV screens.
Hey, Arlie, there's a woman in some kind of isolation chamber over in the warehouse.
I know, the guard said.
He kept his gaze on the screens above him. The door slammed as the informant left. They heard his feet running down the hallway. Beckett looked up at the screens then, realizing that the one on the far right showed a close-up of the end of the Browder's pressure chamber. Faint movement could be seen through the glass of the port. Shiles entered presently, his usually neat uniform appearing a bit mussed. He took in the situation in the room and said,
"You can leave, Arthur. Take over on the upstairs monitors."
The guard left with one last longing look at the far right screen. When the door closed, Shiles said,
"We were wrong not to let Y in from the first. He was in my office this evening, making guarded allusions to some extremely exciting spin-offs from your breakthrough. Give us a handle on no end of things," he says.
"Some bent nose coming up," Beckett said.
"We could blame it on your frog friend," Shiles said.
Beckett stared at him with a dawning realization. The English had it bred in the bone never to trust anyone from beyond their shores. And that would include Bill Beckett, Danza, and Lepikoff, as well as Hupp. How the hell were they supposed to put this world back together in the middle of that kind of shit? "If there's any blame, I'll take it," Beckett said.
"Awfully decent of you," Shiles said. "But do you have any real appreciation of the forces we are holding in check? Blame can be quite dangerous."
Beckett looked at Shiles with care now, thinking about the sullen, volcanic potential simmering out there, most of it held back poorly by the hope that a cure for the plague might someday be produced. And what was the last estimate on the ratio between the sexes? 8,000 men for every surviving woman. And the ratio was growing more outrageous by the day.
"Don't want to have Y throwing you to the lions," Shiles said.
How could Wycombe Finch throw anybody anywhere? Beckett wondered. What was happening here?
"I thought we had an agreement, General," Beckett said. "Oh, we do, old chappie. We certainly do. Big necessities coming up, though. Who gets the serum and who doesn't? Who gets the women, etc., etc.?"
He broke off, hearing the door behind him opening slowly. Wycombe Finch peered in.
"Oh, there you are, Bill. And General." The director let himself into the office and closed the door. "Thought I might find you two here."
"What is it, Y?" Shiles asked.
"Well, actually, it's rather embarrassing."
He glanced at the monitors, then back to Beckett.
"Must bite the bullet, I guess."
"Please do," Shiles said. Wycombe Finch took a deep breath.
"Been listening to your conversation," he said. "Not the first time. Bad habit of mine. Always has been. Curiosity, you know."
Shiles glanced at Beckett with an I-told-you-so look.
"Stoney and I have shared our views on these matters," Wycombe Finch said. "He'll be bringing the King and the Prime Minister into the picture tonight, most likely."
Shiles rubbed at his neck, his attention fixed on Wycombe Finch's mouth, a slow flush mounting from beneath his collar.
"Stoney can be quite obtuse at times," Wycombe Finch said. "Good political head, though. Knew that when we were in school. Afraid we've taken the bit in our teeth, you two."
"What have you done?" Beckett managed.
"Well, very early on, Finn Doheny and I concluded we might need a means of emergency communication. Radio's a hobby of mine, you know. I've an American product. CB, you call it? I've, changed it a bit, of course. More powerful. Antenna in the attic, that sort of thing. Barrier Command popped onto us quite early, but they didn't seem to mind so long as we spoke in the open. I tried to reach old Finn earlier. Can't raise a peep. Bad show over there, I'm afraid. But Barrier Command now has your serum formula and the jolly old biochemical picture, all that. It's Stoney's view that they'll pass it along to America and all the others."
"Bloody hell," Shiles said.
"Don't want any violence, you understand," Wycombe Finch said.
"Awfully attractive prize.
Have to share it, don't you see? Can't have people coming in here with guns and things, taking it."
Beckett began to laugh, shaking his head.
"Ho-ho! Wait till I break this to Joe."
"I do believe Lepikoff's already told him," Wycombe Finch said.
"Amusing fellow, the Russian. Quoted me an old Russian saying, 'Whoever starts a conspiracy
plants a seed.
Very good, what? You never know what the seed'll produce until it comes out of the ground, Beckett said.
He looked at Shiles. The flush had completely covered the general's face.
Government couldn't permit a small group to control the fruits, you know, Wycombe Finch said.
Shiles found his voice.
I swear to you, sir, that my concern was to form a distribution system to make sure it was apportioned equably.
Of course it was, old chap, Wycombe Finch said.
There'll be plenty for everybody, Beckett said.
He looked at Shiles. The general had begun to regain his composure.
And you're still in command of a sizable chunk of the military, General.
But I shall have to obey the government, Shiles said. It's what I was trying to explain to you earlier.
The Irish always seem to me like a pack of hounds dragging down some noble stag.
Goethe.
The coming of the mob ignited a strange new personality in Kevin O'Donnell. Doheny glimpsed it only briefly as he and the other principals of the trial were taken out under guard, ordered locked up in the rooms under the castle's tower. Kevin turned first to the jury and told them to find weapons. They no longer were jurymen, but soldiers at Armageddon. A distant look of dreaming took over Kevin's face. He gestured broadly with his right hand and took up the jar with Alex Coleman's head, saying, "Come watch it, Alex. This is the moment for which I was born." Herodes's corpse he ignored, except to topple the chair and body as he left the room, striding along, Doheny thought, like God Almighty. As his party was rushed across the courtyard by the guards, Doheny noted that the gates had been closed, shutting off the view of the lock. The cries of the mob were loud in the courtyard, though, an all-male animal demanding its due. Some were screaming, "The cure! Give us the cure!" Now what had made them think a cure already had been produced? The guards hustled Doheny into the bailey behind John, Father Michael, and the boy, but not before he glimpsed Kevin once more striding along the parapet of the old castle. Kevin did not deign to glance down at the mob that was shouting out there. His manner said he considered them a pack of brutes hungering for the food of the gods, the manna that only he controlled.
"Give us the cure! Give us O'Neill!"
Doheny and his companions were herded to the door at the head of the dungeon keep. The guards thrust them through the door and slammed it behind them, not bothering to lock them in their individual cells. They stumbled down the long stairs to the chant of the mob, which had returned to its original demand,
"O'Neill! O'Neill!"
They stopped in the room of jumbled discards at the bottom of the stairs. Father Michael brushed cobwebs off his face. John returned to his cell and entered it. The boy climbed up on the broken sofa, trying to peer out of a barred window high on the wall. The mob's sound was loud there. John emerged presently, wearing the clothing the guards had made him discard. It was damp and marked with patches of slime, which he tried to wipe away with the lab coat.
"Why did they take away my clothes?" he asked, his voice distant.
"Was it because the priest had a knife?"
"It's all right, John,"
Father Michael said. He put a hand on John's shoulder. There was a deep trembling in the man. The boy was clambering across the stack of lumber in the corner, still unable to reach the barred window.
"Give it up, lad," Doheny said.
"You'll fall and hurt yourself." A great roar came from the mob. There was a quick burst of automatic weapons fire, then silence. Even the chanting stopped.
"What do you suppose they're doing out there?"
Father Michael asked.
"Sharpening their scythes, their pruning hooks and pitchforks, most likely," Doheny said. "Preparing for the jokerie."
The last word was almost drowned in another mob roar that shook the room. John seemed not to hear. He was staring up at the boy on the stack of lumber, remembering him as he had been during their tramp across the countryside. There was a feral energy in the boy now, a tension and purpose about him.
"Father Michael,"
the boy called, his voice low and intense.
"There's a tunnel back here."
"A tunnel, is it? The priest scrambled over the discards toward the boy, pulling boards aside and peering behind him. He lifted his head and spoke to Doheny.
"There's fresh air. It's a way out."
He pulled out more boards, exposing a low opening.
"Bring John."
Doheny took John's arm.
"Come along."
"I can't," John said. "O'Neill doesn't want to go."
He swept a wild gaze around the dark room.
"Why have they come? I don't..."
The rest of it was lost in another roar from the crowd and more gunfire. The mob sounds became a rhythmic assault. No words, just hoarse and inarticulate noises. A gigantic grunting that filled Doheny with terror. Father Michael darted across the junk and took John's right arm.
"I think we'll have to drag him,"
Doheny said.
"Come with us, John," the priest said. "We're trying to save you, aren't we, Finn?"
"We are that."
"Will you take O'Neill too?"
John asked.
"Of course,"
Father Michael said.
"But where is he?"
John asked.
"He was in the jar on the table." "I don't see him."
"He's already gone on," Doheny said.
"Oh."
John allowed himself to be led in a stumbling scramble across the junk and around the stacked wood. The boy awaited them there in an arched passage of moldy stone. The floor underfoot was slippery with slime, and there were upturned stones, puddles of water. The smell of sewage seeped through the cracks. Doheny listened to the mob sounds overhead. The thumping of many feet could be felt. The gunfire had been reduced to a few scattered shots. Father Michael pushed John down the passage ahead of him. The boy led. There was faint light ahead, but it was dark and odorous in the tunnel. Presently they saw patchy daylight ahead, framed in bushes and partly blocked by an iron grating. Father Michael waved them all to a stop at the grating, listening. The mob was a dim sound behind them. No more gunfire. Doheny realized they had stopped in a small stone hut, piled on both sides with rusty gardening tools. Hoes, rakes, shovels, trowels, hand cultivators. Rows of earthenware pots had fallen from rotted shelves, and the broken shards ground underfoot with bits and pieces of wire and rust-eaten cans. Daylight leaked through chinks in the stone and through a doorway partly blocked by a gate of rusty iron and thick shrubbery. John closed his eyes and hugged his arms close. He breathed in shallow gasps, flexing and tensing his fingers. The boy crept out under the shrubbery and could be heard moving around the hut. Doheny touched one of John's hands and was rewarded with an abrupt upward jerking of the head, eyes wide open and glaring. Father Michael waved for Doheny to stay and went after the boy. He returned in a moment to say, "This hut sits beside an old glass house, and there's an overgrown trail that seems to go out to the road. The boy's gone on ahead to scout it." The priest nodded at John.
"Is he saying anything?"
"It's fascinating," Doheny said, caught up in clinical observation of John.
"Controlled displacement of identity, I think. He knows there's another persona present, and may even talk to it, but I doubt he can overcome the dissociation."
Father Michael shuddered.
"Whatever shall we do with him?"
At Father Michael's words, John squatted on the filthy floor and hid his face against his knees, crouching like a hunted animal in its den.
"It would kill him to restore him to O'Neill,"
Doheny thought. Where had that boy got to? A sudden chilling thought welled up in Doheny's awareness. Kevin had said the boy was ready to spring the hangman's trap under O'Neill. Had the boy gone to alert Kevin or the mob? A noise at the doorway brought his attention away from John. The boy slipped through the opening. He appeared subdued, more like his silent self. He gestured for them to follow him and went back outside. The bushes swished with his passage.
"There's a sweet lad," Father Michael said, "and his soul guided by the Sacred Heart." "I hope you're right," Doheny thought.
"Up we go, John," he said, and helped John to his feet. Father Michael ahead and Doheny behind, they got John out of the hut into the open air. It was an overgrown park with tall evergreens all around, a glimpse of the loch through the trunks. A narrow stone-flagged walkway with bushes overhanging it led away from the loch. The boy was not to be seen. Single file, with Father Michael still leading and Doheny bringing up the rear, they forced their way along the flagstone walk. Bushes constricted the passage. Limbs whipped at them. Father Michael turned his back on the obstructions and pulled John along, feeling for the flagstones with cautious steps. Doheny held a warding arm in front of his face. They emerged presently through a hedge screen onto a narrow macadam roadway, its surface pocked with jagged potholes. The boy waited for them at the hedge, and as they emerged, he turned and set off to the left, away from the castle. Doheny hesitated, listening. There wasn't a sign of the mob, nor a sound. The silence felt sinister.
"Come along," Father Michael whispered.
"He feels it too," Doheny thought. Well, flight was the only sensible thing at this moment. Father Michael trotted off after the boy, who was almost 100 meters ahead now. Doheny and John followed. John appeared willing to go, Doheny guiding him with a light grip on the left arm, but there was a slackness in him, as though he had no volition except that imparted by his companion. The road turned at the end of a long, tree-lined avenue and began to climb away from the loch, turning sharply back and forth into the hills. They came after a panting climb to a lookout point with a weed-overgrown rock fence and the sign still standing. Its arrow directed them to Bally, and the rest of it defaced.
"That'll be Ballymore, I believe," Father Michael said.
The boy had gone out to the edge of the lookout, where he stared back toward the loch. The others joined him, passing a screen of tall trees and gaining at last a view down to the castle. Flames leaped from windows and roof. Smoke drew a vertical column in the windless air. Father Michael shuddered at the sight of the smoke, remembering the smoke at Maynooth. And there was a mob here, too. All four of the watchers stared silently off across the treetops toward the castle, perhaps a kilometer away. A solid mass of people filled the grounds, a moving carpet of people. They were pressed body to body, and the movement above them was hands waving, the glistening of weapons. The skin-crawling thing, though, was the silence. Not a shout, no outcries, no chanting, just that silent movement.
"Saints preserve us," Father Michael breathed.
The boy crept close to Father Michael and held the priest's arm. John, noting the priest and the boy, thought them familiar figures. Yes, they had come a long way over the countryside. He turned to his left and saw an unfamiliar face.
"Who are you?"
John asked.
"I'm Finn Doheny. Where's Joseph?"
Doheny understood and said,
"I'm taking Joseph Herity's place."
"Where are we going now?" John asked. Before Doheny could answer, Father Michael held up a hand and said,
"Listen."
They all heard it then. Horsemen coming down the road from above them. A group of horsemen came around a bend in the road. In the lead rode a tall, bearded man carrying a rifle across the pommel. He lifted the rifle for his followers to stop when he saw the group at the lookout. The bearded man stared a moment at the people below him. His companions remained behind the screen of trees, only the noses of two horses exposed. Seeing no display of weapons from the party at the lookout, the bearded man lowered his rifle. He spoke over his shoulder.
"Wait here."
He rode down then and stopped at the edge of the road. Doheny noted foam at the horse's bit. These men had been riding hard.
"What's happening off there to the castle?" the bearded man asked, gesturing with his chin. "We were just looking at it ourselves," Doheny said. "Looks like a mob." "And who might you be, if I may make so bold as to ask?"
the horseman asked.
"My name's Fintan,"
Doheny said. And this is Father Michael, and...
A priest now, the bearded man said.
Would you be bound for Ballymore?
It's God's own truth about the miraculous cures from our spring water.
Father Michael looked up the hill, his expression saying, Why not? He nodded.
Yes, we'll be drinking the waters at Ballymore, God willing.
A miraculous thing it is, the bearded man said. He leaned forward in the saddle and peered at John, who ducked his head and closed his eyes at this attention.
And what's the matter with your friend?
Doheny wet his lips with his tongue, catching a fearful glance from Father Michael. Before either of them could compose an answer, the boy stepped forward and took John's hand.
"We're going to your spring, mister. This is my father. He's been this way since my mother died."
The horseman straightened. His voice sad, he said,
"There's many that way. God help us all."
Turning in the saddle, he shouted to his companions,
"Des, bring the packet of bread and cheese."
He turned to Father Michael.
"I notice you carry no food. It's a ways to Ballymore. We'll share, and pray you'll stay with us at Ballymore."
He nodded beyond the castle.
"We've business down in Killaloe. Could you be telling us how to get through yon mob?"
"Business in Killaloe?" Doheny asked.
"I'm Alden Caniff, the leading man of Ballymore," the bearded man said. "We're escorting Erskine McGinty down to Killaloe, where it's said they have a wireless to talk across the waters. Erskine's had a vision commanding him to tell the new Pope about our waters."
"I don't know about any wireless at Killaloe," Doheny said.
"It's well known," Caniff said. "The new Pope, you know, is called Adam, for the new beginning. Himself, as was David Shaw. Imagine, a simple priest one day, a cardinal the next, and now he's the Pope."
"If you're bound for Killaloe, I'd stay off the roads," Doheny said. "Mobs are a dangerous thing."
"Good advice, Mr. Finton," Caniff said. "It's Alden Caniff himself as thanks you for it."
A horseman came from behind the screening trees and reined up beside Caniff. The second horseman was a slender youth with straggling black hair. It framed a thin face with a gap-toothed smile. He carried a rifle in his left hand, which also held the reins. A leather bag was in the other hand. He lowered the bag to Father Michael. Caniff looked at his companion.
"Go tell the others to head back the way we come. You mind the path we saw? Wait for me at the path. We'll be leaving the road."
The other horseman reined around and returned behind the trees. Caniff looked at Father Michael, who stood clutching the leather bag in both hands.
"The way's secure to Ballymore, Father. You'll find it marked by stones, piles of seven and a pointer to the way. Just you be careful crossing to N6, and stay away from Moat.
Evil men in Moat. If anyone stops you, say you're under the protection of Alden Caniff."
"Go with God,"
Father Michael said. Caniff kicked his horse, reined it around, and soon was hidden by the trees. They heard the clatter of departing hooves. Doheny waited for the sounds of the horsemen to fade. He looked at Father Michael then. The priest nodded. They both understood. If any of Kevin O'Donnell's people had survived the mob, John and his companions could be identified. Word could get out that a priest, a boy, and two men had been seen on the road to Ballymore.
"We dare not cut across to Dundalk," Doheny said. "They'd expect us to head for my friends."
Father Michael looked at John, who stood staring off at the loch. The boy still held John's hand, a penetrating look on the young face as though he were trying to peer into John for the answers to strange questions. They would have to name the boy soon, since he would not reveal his original name. A new name. The boy wanted a second baptism, admitting that he had been blessed in the church. But that was all he would admit.
"We have a rare cargo to protect," Father Michael said.
"I'm hungry, Father Michael," John said. "Did Joseph leave us any food?"
"We'll eat soon,"
Doheny said. "We should be getting off this road.
We've been lucky in our encounter, but there's danger depending only on the luck of the wayfarer." He turned and led them up the road, hearing the others follow. When he glanced back, he saw the boy guiding John, still holding his hand. Nightfall found them far along a narrow path winding through thick evergreens. Doheny knew the kind of track they followed, a woodcutter's way, and there would be a shelter of sorts along it. Plenty of firewood around as well, to keep them through what promised to be a cold night. They had crossed several country roads and once had waited, peering out of the bushes before running across a wider paved highway. Doheny did not know precisely where they were, but he had marked the position of the sun and knew they had headed generally east. If they could avoid the beach boys. John followed with the docility of fatigue. He walked alone now, the boy and the priest bringing up the rear. John seldom looked up from where he would put his next step. Shelter was more or less where Doheny expected to find it, just over a rise into a small swale that would protect it from the west winds. It was a lean-to built of poles and caulked with mud and moss. The door was more poles held by three sets of cross-pieces and hung on leather hinges with a stick latch. There were no windows, but a small hole penetrated the roof near a corner with a fire pit beneath and a stack of wood stored nearby. The interior smelled of forest duff and smoke. John flopped to the floor and sat with his back against a wall. Father Michael dropped his leather sack and stared around the gloomy interior. The boy joined John. In the last of the daylight, Doheny started a fire and squatted in front of it, warming his hands. Father Michael closed the door and propped a stick of wood against it. The boy crept around the wall behind the fire, taking advantage of the reflected heat. John got to his feet and moved aimlessly around the confined space. Father Michael watched him carefully. John stopped suddenly and spoke. "O'Neill doesn't like it here." Father Michael glanced fearfully at Doheny crouched by the fire. Doheny stared back at the priest and motioned him closer. Father Michael edged around John and stood with his back to the fire looking down at Doheny. Steam started to rise from the damp places on the priest's clothing. "Will O'Neill say why he doesn't like this place?" Father Michael asked. Doheny waved a hand to make him stop. Did the priest not understand? O'Neill could not be brought out of this human shell. The man had seen too much of the terrible consequences brought on by his plague. Revenge he might have wanted, but this... Father Michael stared down at Doheny with a puzzled frown. John remained silent, his head cocked to one side as though listening. Only an amoral monster could live with this Ireland on his conscience, Doheny thought. Everything they had learned about O'Neill said he had been a man of conscience, at least before Herodes' bomb. John straightened his head suddenly and spoke.
"O'Neill says this world is not safe."
He looked down at Doheny.
"Did Joseph leave you one of his guns?"
"No need of guns here," Doheny said, getting stiffly to his feet.
"Is there any more of that bread and cheese, Father?"
"Enough for the night, on the morrow," Father Michael said. The boy came around from behind the fire and joined them. His clothing smelled of steamed wool.
"O'Neill's right," the boy said, a pensive adult quality in his thin voice. "Guns and bombs make a crazy world, and that's not safe."
"Madmen and children speak the truth," Doheny thought. "Precious Trinity! Will we ever see a sane world?" Father Michael asked. "Where a man can tell his lies with impunity," Doheny said.
"That's a cruel thing to say, Mr. Doheny."
Doheny turned his head and listened to the wind soughing through the trees around the hut. The fire flickered in a draft that swept through the scanty poles. Shadow monsters danced upon the walls.
"Cruel, yes," Doheny said. "But change is often cruel, and that's what's happening. Change. We haven't been living close enough to what our world's doing."
"Close enough?" Father Michael was shocked.
the killing, the savagery.
I believe I am a realist, Doheny said. Most people lived in a four-sided world with guardians at all the gates. Doctors, preachers, lawyers, elected demagogues, to keep away the surprises of change.
Then how is it this terrible plague surprised the guardians? Father Michael demanded.
Because they got caught up in that world too. A universe bounded by the weekly pay packet, the nightly television schedule, the annual holiday, and an occasional dispensation of goodies and circus.
I still don't understand how it could happen, Father Michael said, his voice barely above a whisper.
He looked fearfully at John, who had walked to the door and stood peering out through a crack by the hinges.
Because we listened only to the rich Americans, Doheny said.
Oh, I didn't know you hated Americans, Father Michael said.
Hate 'em? No, I envied 'em.
But so few of them ever lived close to what the world's doing.
You keep saying that, Father Michael protested. What does it mean?
It means the very poor who know they may starve. It means sailors and farmers and woodsmen who walk close to nature's ever-ready disasters. It means the prophets who scourge themselves until they can see past the pain.
Father Michael looked at the boy, who stood listening to them, an avid expression on his face. The night sounds of wind and forest pressed close around them.
What could John see through that crack by the door? It was only woods, darkness out there.
The guardians were false guardians, Doheny said, his voice low and thoughtful.
They said they would let only good surprises come through packages from Father Christmas. Nothing would be allowed to disrupt the smooth world that the four square inhabitants believed they possessed.
John turned and met Father Michael's gaze. There was an odd look of alertness and wonder in John's eyes, the priest thought.
Where are we? John asked.
It's a woodsman's shelter, Doheny said, not looking up from the fire. John focused on Doheny.
And who are you?
Doheny shook his head, still not looking at John, half lost in his own deep thoughts.
I've the name Fintan Craig Doheny, and I'm no better guardian than any of the others.
He turned then and saw in the flickering firelight the strangely alert expression on John's face.
How did we get here? John asked.
His voice low and hesitant, Doheny said,
We walked. That's odd, John said. You sound Irish. Am I still in Ireland?
Doheny nodded.
I wonder where Mary and the twins are, John said.
Father Michael and Doheny looked at each other. The boy asked,
What's happening?
Doheny shook a finger at him for silence.
I'm John Roe O'Neill, John said. I know that. Have I had amnesia? No, that can't be it. I seem to remember things.
Doheny lifted himself on the balls of his feet, poised for any response to sudden violence from John.
Who brought me here? John asked.
You were brought by John Garrick O'Donnell, Father Michael said.
John shot a startled look at the priest.
John Garrick?
His eyes went wide with shock. He stepped back until he was pressed against the wall by the door. His gaze went from Doheny to Father Michael to the boy, lingering there, and they could all but see the memories whirl behind John's eyes. Doheny raised a hand toward him. John's mouth opened, a round hole in an agonized face.
No!
It was an eerie wail from that open mouth. He took a step toward Doheny, who stiffened.
John whirled then and hurled himself against the door, smashing it open. Before anyone could prevent it, John was outside, running and screaming, crashing through the trees. Doheny put out an arm to prevent Father Michael or the boy from following.
You couldn't catch him. And even if you did.
He shook his head. They listened to the sounds from the darkness. The wailing screams, the thrashing of underbrush. It went on for a long time, fading away at last into the distance, at one with the wind in the trees.
Someone must find him, Father Michael said. Someone must give him shelter. The madman's a special charge upon us all, and he should...
Oh, shut up, Doheny snapped. He went to the doorway and restored the door, propping it in position against the night. When he turned back to the fire, the boy was staring at him, listening to the faint sounds from the darkness. Could the youth's young hearing still detect those screaming wails?
It's the banshee, the boy whispered.